Exodus chapter 7. You know, when I was in college, one of my favorite professors, C.W. Lincoln, great with a great sense of humor, always enjoyed, he would joke and say lots of anecdotal things that were just as really were worth even more than the class itself. I always appreciated him for that. And we used to call him Honest Abe because of his last name being Lincoln. But anyhow, I remember he used to say to us all the time, he says, my children are really sensitive. If they get a line, you just slap the child next to them and they'll straighten right up just like that. And, I used to laugh about it a lot more, but then I had children of my own and I realized, you know, some kids really are just that sensitive, you know. I've had some of my kids, I have five children. Some are very sensitive, others unyielding, you know. And I know, like, for instance, Joel, who shared communion earlier, and Hannah, they're both always been the kind of kid that you could slap the kid next to them, and they were, you know, right there, you know. And then my other three, you know, just real strong personalities, Tyler, Matt, Emma, you know, I don't think slapping them or the person next to that, it would be an act of war, no matter what, you know. Here's the deal, though. One of the things that I found in raising those kids that are so very different from one another is that sometimes the things that I do aren't always, the value of them isn't always in their reaction or how it works through them. But some things are just right responses regardless of their response. One of the things that I have had to deal with in the issues of justice in the land and things like that is, you know, sometimes, you know, for instance, somebody commits grand theft auto and they take someone's car or whatever and we put them in prison. Well, you know, it doesn't always produce a better citizen. The reality is that some people will respond to that in a very positive way and they will never steal another car again. And there'll be other people who will continue to steal cars and it won't change their heart at all. But the action is appropriate in the sense of grand theft auto. That's a big crime and there's not a lot else that we can do. And so it really has more to do with the person's response to what happens than whether or not the action was the right thing. Now, sometimes, you know, knowing my kids or individuals, I choose specific actions for specific children. I tailor what I'm doing to deal with that child so that I get the greatest impact, the greatest change in their heart. But, there's just sometimes that the only response is a swat on the behind or a grounding or whatever else, regardless of how they respond to the discipline that I'm giving them. And, you know, here's the thing is that I think my kids would say to you that I'm fairly permissive about some things. I don't care about technicolor hair colors. You know, those things don't bother me, or length of hair, style of clothing. I'm really not even that interested in the type of music being a big deal to me as much as what's in the music and things like that. But, you know, the one thing that I really don't handle well is defiant behavior. In other words, if you don't agree with the punishment I'm meeting out, then you are free to respond in a respectful way and say to me, you know, I think, Dad, that's over the top. I think it's unfair or whatever. And I'll hear you out. And I might even change my mind. I'm pretty good about stuff like that. But the reality is the moment that the behavior becomes defiant, that you react instead of act in wisdom, that just gets my back up and it becomes just a more difficult conflict in the moment and nothing gets better like that. It doesn't affect the change that they want. Here's the thing, one of the things that I've noticed repeatedly, you know, is that the sun, as it shines on the earth, that the same sun that melts the butter hardens the clay. You see, it's not a different sun, it's a different material that's experiencing the sun's rays. And the thing is that the difference in material speaks more than the sun does. And sometimes the actions of God melt the heart of some people and harden the heart of other people, but it's less a reflection of God and more about the heart and its reception to the message. Exodus chapter 7, we're taking a look at the Battle of the Nile in Operation Desert Freedom between Egypt and Israel. The battle is on. The Battle of the Nile, it's a huge blow to the Egyptians. But even as the Egyptians are limping away, Pharaoh is shaking his fist in defiance in the face of God, and Moses determined that he will continue the fight. Let's take a look. Exodus chapter 7. I'll be reading from the English Standard Version. Please read along in whatever translation you have on your lap, or you can follow along on the screen overhead. But my favorite translation is the one in your lap. Exodus chapter 7, beginning in verse 1. And the Lord said to Moses, "See, I have made you like a god to Pharaoh, and brother Aaron shall be your prophet. And you shall speak all that I have commanded you, and your brother Aaron shall tell Pharaoh to let the people of Israel go out of his land. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and though I multiply my signs and wonders in the land of Egypt, Pharaoh will not listen to you. Then I will lay my hand on Egypt and bring my host, my people, the children of Israel, out of the land of Egypt by great acts of judgment. The Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, and when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring all the people of Israel from among them," and Moses and Aaron did so. They did just as the Lord had commanded them. And now Moses was 80 years old, and Aaron 83 years old when they spoke to Pharaoh. Then the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "When Pharaoh says to you, 'Prove yourselves by working a miracle,' then you shall say to Aaron, 'Take your staff and cast it down before Pharaoh, that it may become a serpent.' So Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and did just as the Lord commanded. And Aaron cast down his staff before Pharaoh and his servants, and it became a serpent. Then Pharaoh summoned the wise men and the sorcerers and all the magicians of Egypt, and they also, with their secret arts, did the same. For each man cast down his staff, and it became a serpent. But Aaron's staff swallowed up their staffs, and still Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he would not listen to them as the Lord had said. So then the Lord said to Moses, 'Pharaoh's heart is hardened, and he refuses to let the people go. Go to Pharaoh in the morning as he's out at the water. Stand on the bank of the Nile to meet him and take in your hand the staff that turned into a serpent. And you shall say to him, "The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, sent me to you saying, "Let my people go that they may serve me in the wilderness." But so far you have not obeyed. Thus says the Lord, by this you shall know that I am the Lord. Behold, with the staff that is in my hand, I will strike the water that is in the Nile, and it shall turn into blood. And the fish in the Nile shall die, and the Nile will stink, and the Egyptians will grow weary of drinking water from the Nile. And the Lord said to Moses, "Say to Aaron, 'Take your staff, stretch out your hand over the waters of Egypt, over the rivers, over their canals, over their ponds, and the pools of water, so that they may become blood, and there shall be blood throughout all the land of Egypt, even in vessels of wood and in vessels of stone.'" Moses and Aaron did as the Lord commanded in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants. And he lifted up the staff and struck the water in the Nile. And all the water in the Nile turned into blood. And the fish in the Nile died. And the Nile stank. And so that the Egyptians could not drink the water from the Nile. And there was blood throughout all the land of Egypt. But the magicians of Egypt did the same by their secret arts. So Pharaoh's heart remained hardened. And he would not listen to them as the Lord had said. So Pharaoh turned and went into his house, and he did not even take this into his heart. And all the Egyptians dug along the Nile for water to drink, but they could not drink the water of the Nile. And 7 days passed after the Lord had struck the Nile. All right. Well, you know, here's the thing is that whenever we come upon this whole thing of God hardening Pharaoh's heart, it really is, you know, a big worrisome. It's a stumbling block to a lot of people. They read the text like that. And they just kind of go, wow, how could a loving God do that? How can Pharaoh be guilty if the Lord hardened his heart? And my answer goes back to this whole crazy deal of freedom and liberty, of the autonomy of the human being. It's just, it is amazing to me that because we were created in the image of God, let that kind of sink into your head, into your heart for a moment. We are created in the image of God, and that there is something distinct about our nature and the way in which we were created, different than all of the rest of creation. We have a level of autonomy not even known to the angels. And so as a result, a large part of our pain is created by our own actions and by the actions of other human beings, also created in the image of God with the same kind of autonomy and freedom and liberty. without any interference from the demonic, or even, you know, without it having anything to do with God's intervention. We are perfectly capable of creating tremendous pain for ourselves and for one another. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, we do things all the time that affect other people in a negative way. We do things that affect ourselves. And so when God does act in a way that he intervenes in the world, is it any wonder that sometimes, you know, people rebel against that? Let's just think about things that God has done in the world. He gave Adam and Eve everything that they could possibly need. And he said, just don't do this one thing. One thing, you know, I can't get really upset at Adam, you know, or Eve in this whole thing, because to be honest, there's a part of me that says, you know, thank you, Lord, that it didn't get all the way to me before somebody messed up, you know? I don't want to be the biblical story of Hal who ate the fruit, okay? Because I know me. Don't you know you? Don't you know? Don't kid yourself, right? You're not the person who would have not eaten the fruit, right? See, we know who we are. We know who we are. And the deal is that it doesn't really matter what the circumstances are, that there is continually this thing within us that does not want to be told what to do, no matter how great, no matter how small. And when God acted in human history to set the Hebrews free, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, responds like, oh, you're not going to tell me what to do. It says he hardened his heart. But, you know, here's the truth is when you look at those actions, what God did in turning the river to blood and sending the serpent in the cane, you know, most anyone else, would have been afraid in that moment. Have you thought about this? Okay, look, I enjoy sleight of hand and theatrical magic. I just think it's fun to watch them do amazing things. I remember when David Copperfield, like, made the Statue of Liberty disappear. And I was like, wow. Now that's impressive. I was really impressed. But here's the thing. There is something distinctively different, because I know that there's a natural explanation for those things. There's something distinctly different between that and what was done in front of Pharaoh. Here's the deal. They're practicing the art of deception. And in contrast, there is the outright miracle of Moses. When it talks about the serpent here, one of the things that isn't really clear, and I checked every English translation looking for someone to translate this more accurately, and it just isn't there, and I don't know why it is, why it isn't there, but the deal is that the Hebrew word here is not just a snake. See, when they throw down their staves, it's a snake. It says when Moses threw down his staff, the words there mean a monstrous reptile. A monstrous reptile. Could be a very large snake, could be a crocodile, could be a dragon. Same term, okay? Hebrew is not a very exact language. I know people think they're going to learn Hebrew and it's going to fix all their problems reading the Bible, and I can tell you, it doesn't, okay? Hebrew is a very loose language. When a man has compassion, it says that he's pregnant, okay? Does that give you an idea of how inexact? So you get a man's pregnant and a woman is pregnant. One of them has compassion, and then the woman, is she pregnant? Or is she having compassion? Answer is yes. You know, there is a phenomenological language, and so it looks at things that happen in society and points to them. And so it just says, a monstrous reptile. I don't know. It could have been a crocodile when he threw down the staff. I don't know what it was, but it was monstrous, and it was a reptile. And then it says, and he devoured their serpents. Okay, I know Prince of Egypt is, you know, it's for kids, and there's like the nice little slurp, and even the way it says it here, you might get the idea. It says it sucked them. No, it says he devoured them. I want you to think bloody, disgusting mess. A reptile ripped apart and devoured those other reptiles. It was a horrific scene. They should have gone, whoa! And instead, this hard-headed, thick-headed guy looks at that and goes, oh, yeah, well, we did it too. I mean, that is the ultimate bravado. He doesn't learn anything from the moment. But that's okay. God is patient. God, you know, sends Moses out to the river the next day. And then he says, look, you're not listening? I'm going to turn the river to blood. Now, okay, if you can take a bucket of water and go abracadabra and it turns red in front of my eyes, I'm impressed, okay? I am. I'm impressed. You know, that's a great magic trick. If you do that and you turn it into a bucket of blood, I'm also impressed, but now I'm thinking it's a little dark. You know, like, wow, why'd you, you know, like, yuck, you know? But a Nile River? The Nile? Do you realize that at its narrowest point, it's over a mile wide. At some places, it's over 7 miles wide. I don't know where they were standing at that moment. 1 mile, 7 miles. Either way, I'm impressed. When you turn the whole stinking river into blood and fish die and the stench of blood fills the air. I think that's a little beyond making the Statue of Liberty disappear for a few seconds. This ought to be rattling his cage. And instead in bravado, he goes, yeah, well, we turned a bucket of water into blood. Like, really? Can you imagine the hard-heartedness that has to be in that moment that you would look at something that would make most people melt or faint and be fearful? You know, here's the thing is that, did you know that the Egyptians thought of the Nile as a god? And why not? Let's think about it from their perspective in their day and age before technology. Why is Egypt so powerful in the middle of the desert and able to conquer other nations? Because they have the Nile. They have food. They have fresh water. When the banks of the Nile overflow in the spring, they're able to grow stuff. They are so powerful that the reason the Nubian kingdom just to the south of them is under their thumb is because when they get mad at the Nubians, they just cut off their water. Oh yeah? Fight us now when you don't have a drink of water. And after a week or so, the Nubians would say, we give. They are the most powerful kingdom on the earth at that time because they have the Nile. It's no wonder they think it's a god. The gods must be on our side. We have the Nile, and we have control of the Nile, and we will cut you off of water, and we will keep you away from food. And when Israel is struggling for food, where do they go for food? While everybody else is experiencing a drought, they come down where the Nile is because that's where the food is. And they say, look, we are abundant in resources. I don't think a nation's ever said this before. We're abundant in resources. Therefore, that proves that we have God's favor and you don't. I'm sure no nation has ever said that. And yet they're about to come under judgment. Hello? But in the midst of this, bravado is just ripe in the air. You could almost smell the testosterone as he high-handed says to God, you know what? I am not going to bow my knee. They are not going anywhere. And for a whole week, he lets his people suffer as they wait for the Nile to be refreshed by the water flowing through it. And just to make sure that they got the message, God sends Aaron to go around and to start tapping other sources of water. So even if you got a swimming pool or you've got a big cistern full of water, it's all filled with blood. You ever gone without water for an entire week? Hello? And I would get my attention. I think I would be afraid. If my most powerful God just got the slap down from the God of the Hebrews, not just overtime, not just in a war or something like that, but in an instant, he got the public smackdown. I'd be thinking, maybe you don't want to mess with this guy. Like, okay, big deal. Let him go out and worship for a little while. Like, please leave and don't turn my water to blood. But bravado is so thick in the air. You ever watched as some people just can't back down from a war? Ever had a child or a boss or a coworker or a friend or a parent who is like that in your life? And all you want to do is you want to ask them to just step back from the ledge, and it seems like they just can't wait to leap off of it right in front of you. You know, one of the things I've realized in that, it's not God's fault. It's not even the devil's fault. It's this brazen pride that lives within every one of us. It's the kind of brazen pride that let Adam watch his wife eat the fruit that carried with it a death sentence. Have you thought about this guy for a moment? I mean, socially, we just think this is, he has been told that the fruit will kill them. And Adam doesn't say a word. He sits there and watches. The text says he's right there. And he watches. Ooh, let's see if it really does kill her. It's not me. Yeah, and before you say, well, boy, they had a messed up family. Remember, this is Grandpa Adam. And anybody in this room getting out of this one. You're a human being. This is Grandpa Adam. This is our family lineage. You get it? We are that brazen, prideful people. We are the descendants of Grandpa Adam, who thought so little of what God had given him, the wife of lifetime. I mean, if anybody else, you can say, well, I know that God picked my spouse, but let me tell you, he knows that God picked his spouse for him. And he watches her eat that fruit. That's jacked up. That's a brazen kind of pride that doesn't need, you know, well, the serpent was there. He's watching. And he does nothing to save her, nothing to protect her. And then is high-handed in the face of God and says, well, it's your fault, that woman that you gave me. The pride. The pride. It's hateful. It's self-deception. It's self-destruction. But you know what it's not? It's not God's fault. It's not. And see, we get this skewed view of the world in which we start to blame God for things that other people do. You know, here's the thing that I figured out a long time ago. If God really disliked us as much as some people want to believe, or if God was his mean spirit and you realize this is the God who made us. And the day that that happened, all he had to do go, well, that didn't work out. Done. Done. Not one of us would have drawn another breath. Done. And yet the heart of God was one in which he said that in Ephesians 1, that as he looked through the hallways of time and saw all of the difficulty of raising people like us, and he said, my solution is Jesus. Not wiping them out, not getting rid of them. My solution is to heal wounds, to work through people. Intriguing, isn't it? See, the main point is that Pharaoh saw the hand of God was against him, but it wasn't enough to stop his behavior. And before we, you know, go on and like start talking trash about Pharaoh, like, you know, the football players are going to do to each other this afternoon and all, and then we'll be watching YouTube videos for the next several weeks on what they shouldn't have said. Why do we do that? Or is it that we realize that there's some of that in us? There's some Sherman in us. There's some Pharaoh in us. And that our actions are often self-destructive, self-deception, and defiance against God. You see, the thing is that as we've been looking at Exodus, you know, most people get trapped up in this whole thing of Exodus of thinking about, oh, the waters parting, and wondering whether or not that miracle, did it happen, did it not happen? And could they see fishies swimming in the side of the water when it was parted? People get all kinds of, you know, things they want to know about that. They want to know, how did they survive in the desert and with all those people and all that food? And how did they multiply that quickly? And we get caught up in all the minutiae. You know, all the little tiny things that don't really matter. But the book of Exodus is about God fulfilling and doing just what he said he would do to fulfill Israel's destiny. He hid them away, he prepared them, and then he launches them out and he covers them and he's watching over them. And we may not like all the details, but here's the deal. God is found faithful, and the whole message throughout Exodus repeatedly is about God's call and his destiny and his purpose for people's lives and his purpose for the people of God and how God will do and bring to fulfillment all of those things. But the one thing that can stand in the way of all that is us. You see, God doesn't always get his way. There are people who hear the message of salvation, and it's the heart of God that everyone would come to the knowledge of salvation, but, well, not everybody does. See, that's that whole free will thing. I don't know why he did that. You know, you ever thought about that? You ever thought to yourself, God, I just wish you'd take that away from me. And then something happens and you go, I'm really glad you didn't take that away from me. We're so fickle, aren't we? We're, as somebody said earlier, I don't know whether my heart is butter or clay or a mixture of both. And all I can say is, yeah, me too. Me too. But you know, here's the thing that amazes me in the midst of this, what's encouraging through all of this. I mean, because we could easily leave a passage like this and just go, wow, you know, that was, well, we, what about this whole obedience thing? And we could be really heavy in our hearts. But here's, let me tell you the encouraging thing. Let me lift your head just a moment. One of the things that encourages me in this text is that when I read this and I realize that I'm not blaming God for the disaster anymore, that I've realized I've grown in my relationship with Christ. I've grown in my trust and my understanding of who God is, and I've come to this conclusion that, oh, God's not the bad guy in the story. God really is the good guy. God really is the one who wants to see people set free. God really is the person who, in any normal situation that his actions would have melted people's heart 10 times. I know this is kind of a spoiler alert, but in this, as we go on through the book of Exodus, there are 10 encounters, and all of them end up the same way. And you know what that means? That God was patient. Even while he was defiant and shaking his fist in the face of God. I can tell you what, you ask my kids, I might pass one test like that if you were shaking your fist in my face. Maybe. But if my kids like did 10 times in a, like, you know, I tell me all about Jesus, you know, when I get there, because you're going to go meet him right now. 10 times. Look at the patience and the kindness and the mercy of God. And I'm just so grateful that I can read that now and I can see that, and it means I'm growing in my relationship with God. But here's the other thing. Even if I'm not in that place yet, even if I'm reading it for the kind of the first time and I seeing this and I'm struggling with Pharaoh's guilt versus God, you know, is God to blame for hardening his heart and all this? And let me tell you, the good news is that now you've heard that story and you have the opportunity to turn toward the Lord and say, you know, God, I'm really wrestling with this. And I need you to do a work in my heart so that I can see this from your perspective. But you see, what it means is that the day's not too late. And the moment's not too late. It means that right now, that you have the opportunity, like Pharaoh had at that very first event, to swallow your brazen pride and to say, God, I don't know how to do this, and I don't know, and everything in me wants to rebel against what you're saying, but I'm going to believe for today that you're good and that you didn't do that to harm him. And grow me up. See, it's a great day because it's not too late. But this is what I know, is that in all of this, that this whole thing of fulfilling your destiny and your call and the purposes that God has in your life, that it begins out of a place of relationship, of surrendering to him, and then continuing to surrender again and again and again. Oh, I just, you know what my greatest prayer in life is? God, could I just grow up before I die? Could I just be mature enough that I see your heart moment by moment in these things, and that I just have complete confidence in you and never shake my fist? That's my prayer. Let me grow up before I die. How about you? It begins in the place of relationship. Maybe you're just in that initial place where you would say, you know, God, I need you. I don't know how to do any of this. All I know is this. I know that I'm like Pharaoh. And I need you to work in my heart. Would you forgive me? Would you cleanse me? Would you make me new? And you call out to the Lord. You know what? We're going to have some prayer team people in the back with some orange badges on. And I know they'd love to talk to you about a new life in Christ. Or maybe you're at that place where you have been walking with the Lord, but you find yourself volleying between the heart of cream and the heart of clay. And you say, God, help me to grow up. Today's the day to simply say that. Just say, maybe you turn to a neighbor, to a friend. Maybe you go back to a prayer team and you say, I don't want to continue the way I am now. I want to grow. I want to grow in my understanding. I want to grow in my relationship with God. And why not do that? Maybe you're just simply in the place where you've grown to the point in the Lord that more often than not, you see that you're listening to the heart of God. You're following after the heart of God. But maybe you just don't have a kind word for Pharaoh. Kind of suffering from elder brother syndrome. You know, that's just as ugly. When we sit in judgment of Pharaoh instead of ourselves. That one's probably the hardest one of all. Can I be honest? To not sit in judgment of Pharaoh and to see me in the heart of Pharaoh. That's my hardest one too. So where do we go from here? The place we go from here is that we look into the face of God and we say, you know, God, I believe from afar all that you have for me, all that you desire for me, all the things that you are wanting to do in me, that you created me for purpose, with destiny, with a plan in mind. And I'm not sure how to get from here to there. But I surrender. That's what it really is all about. Every day, every week, the message doesn't really ever change. It's just from a different point in time. I surrender. Let's stand together.